Suspense, which is heard on Thursday nights at this hour, is taking its customary summer holiday. Suspense returns to the air 5 weeks from now on Thursday, August 31st. Ladies and gentlemen, a $10,000 reward will be offered on the program immediately following this announcement.
You out there, you who think you've committed the perfect crime, the perfect murder, and that there are no clues, no witnesses, that your identity is unknown, listen.
Somebody knows.
Yes, you, wherever you may be, no matter where you're hiding, somewhere, sometime, someone listening to this program is going to bring you to justice. Yes.
Somebody knows.
The Columbia Broadcasting System presents Somebody Knows, a program conceived in the public interest, dedicated to aiding the forces of law and order in the solution of this nation's unsolved crimes.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to recreate for you tonight all the known facts in an actual unsolved murder. Somewhere, someone among you has had contact with the killer or killers. Someone whose identity need never be known has seen evidence or possesses information that can lead to the solution of this crime.
In the public interest, the Columbia Broadcasting System offers a $5,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the killer in this unsolved murder.
In tonight's case, in recognition of the efforts being made to apprehend her husband's killer, and hopeful of the results that may be obtained, Mrs. Madeline Christensen, widow of Frank J. Christensen, whose story we bring you tonight, offers an additional $5,000, doubling the original reward.
This makes a total of $10,000 in rewards for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the killer or killers of Frank J. Christensen.
We ask you then to please listen carefully, for you may be the one to win this reward.
Somebody knows.
It may be you. Now we open the files on one of this nation's unsolved murders. It's file number 49-104 from the records of the state's attorney's office in Cook County, Illinois. The unsolved murder of Frank J. Christensen.
The recorder's ready?
He is, Mr. Coroner.
Have these proceedings read into the record?
Yes, sir. Office of the Coroner, Cook County, Illinois. Transcript of testimony taken at the inquest before the Coroner of Cook County, A.L. Brody, Deputy Coroner Lewis J. Ned Herney, and the jury duly impaneled and sworn, 2307 South Laramie Avenue, Cicero, Illinois, 11 a.m., December 13, A.D., 1949. Ready, Mr. Coroner?
Very well. The inquest will please come to order. I'd like to ask you, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any information you can give the police, I wish you'd come forward. If you don't wish to give it publicly, you can speak in private. I'd like to see the streets made safe so people should not be mowed down. All right, I'll take the family history. Mrs. Christensen, will you please step up?
Yes, Mr. Coroner.
Swear the witness in.
All right, Mrs. Christensen. Raise your right hand.
Yes, sir.
At 11 o'clock in the morning, December 12th, 1949, in the somber atmosphere of Raleigh's funeral home at 2307 South Laramie Avenue in the town of Cicero, state of Illinois, a man's life and death are being probed.
Your residence,
the life and death of a man named Frank J. Christensen.
Yes.
You are the widow of
Under the skillful questioning of A.L. Brody, coroner of Cook County, many pertinent facts are being brought to light. Let's examine them in reference to the case which we're bringing you tonight. It's spring of the year 1946. two men enter a candy and school supply store in the immediate neighborhood of a high school in the town of Cicero, western suburb of Chicago. They stand to one side, looking over the crowded store.
Well, Leo, what do you say?
I wouldn't have believed it, Chris. Slot machines and school stores.
Fine education for the kids of Cicero, isn't it? Learning how to operate those one-armed bandits. Tossing their lunch money into the syndicate's payoff pot. Come on, Leo, before I get sick. You know, that's not the only school store I've seen those machines in, Leo. They're spotted in dozens of them.
What's it mean, Chris? You said the syndicate...
Yes, it looks to me like the syndicate's moving back to Cicero. Something's got to be done about it.
That's almost impossible. Well, they get witnesses willing to stick out their necks far enough to testify. He's going to be crazy enough to put himself on a spot with the hoods from the syndicate.
Leo, I believe that some of the Capone gang have returned. They're operating openly without much hindrance from the law. And if they're allowed to continue, this means return to the days of gangsters, hoodlum killings, and terrorism. But with God's help, I'm going to put a stop to it.
On August 26, 1946, as assessor and village board member, Frank Christensen forces the Cicero Town Board to call a special meeting in order to have a showdown on the gambling issue. An hour before the meeting is to convene, Frank Christensen's in his office, looking over the directive that he and Leo Kaspersky have prepared for the town board. He's almost finished when the door to his office opens.
Christensen?
Yes, that's right. What can I do for you?
He's here. Come on in.
Yeah, sure.
You going to the town board meeting, Christensen?
I am. Why do you ask?
Planning on introducing that resolution you and Kaspersky cooked up about gambling?
What's your interest in that?
Maybe we don't want you should get yourself in trouble.
Who sent you here?
What difference does it make? Maybe you better just lay off.
Well, if that's all you've got to
better
say...
Better listen, Christensen. Wouldn't do you or Kaspersky any good. It got out that you're both taking a payoff from the syndicate.
That's a lie.
Who cares? It could get out anyway. Wouldn't be so good for you, maybe, if it did.
How about it, Christensen? Are we making sense?
Some 30 minutes later, at the meeting of the town board in Cicero, Frank Christensen gives his answer to the two men who had paid him
a
visit in his office.
That it was necessary to file a directive in order to have this board bring into the open the widespread gambling and operation of slot machines now taking place in Cicero. Every day, every one of you must have seen these slot machines in open operation. The board has received letters and complaints from mothers of young children, from the clergy, from employers. It's gone so far that the Chicago newspapers have printed lists with the names and addresses of handbooks and dice games operating in Cicero.
Now, just a minute, Christensen, just a minute. Yeah. The gambling detail investigated those addresses given by the Chicago papers. It didn't find a thing.
Well, then, mister, the gambling detail ought to take a lesson from Cicero's high school kids. They can walk into their school stores and play the slot machines 24 hours a day. If the gambling detail can't find what these kids can find, then there's been a complete breakdown of law enforcement in this town. And that's why Supervisor Kaspersky and I demand that the town board take immediate action to suppress gambling and slot machines, and not to stop until the gambling syndicate's been driven out of Cicero.
With a bombshell of his demand still echoing through the meeting hall, Frank Christensen leaves the town board and returns to his office. Then, as he opens the door and enters...
Hello, Christensen.
I thought I told you two to get out of my office and stay out.
That was a nice speech you made. Very nice. We figured we'd better congratulate you.
On what?
On still being alive. With a guy who sticks his neck out like you do. Who knows? Might be the last time anybody can say that.
If you have a job to be done, try giving it to a physically handicapped worker. Your state rehabilitation agency has done a wonderful job of training disabled workers, many of them veterans, to do a specialized type of work in many different fields. When you hire a physically handicapped worker, you will do him a great service by boosting his morale, and you'll be doing yourself a good turn by acquiring a well-trained, efficient employee. The next time you need someone to do a good job, contact your state employment office and ask for a physically handicapped worker. Now back to Somebody Knows and a true case history of an actual murder.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we'll continue with the rest of the factual information concerning the unsolved murder of Frank J. Christensen. File number 49-104 from the records of the State's Attorney's Office of Cook County, Illinois.
Remember, $10,000 will be paid for information leading to the arrest and conviction of his killer.
What is your name?
Charles Cicero.
You are a police officer of the town of Cicero?
That's right. Town of Cicero.
All right, officer. Tell us what you
learned. The coroner's inquest into the death of Frank J. Christensen continues.
Well, we have not
a picture of the man grows clearer. The facts surrounding his battle for reform, for the eradication of gamblers, hoodlums, and gangsters in the town of Cicero, come more and more to light. For 2 more years, despite attempted frame-ups on bribery charges, despite threats made against his life, Frank Christensen continues his determined battle against crime. Then, in 1948, he refuses to run for a third term as assessor. His stated reason...
I'm retiring from politics. From now on, I'm going to devote my time to my private law practice and the real estate business.
Frank Christensen opens a real estate office, and in partnership with Leo Kaspersky, forms the Boulevard Manor Corporation to develop a vast housing project in Cicero. However, he never for one moment stops openly fighting the gambling syndicate. It is now 6:30 on Friday evening, December 9th, 1949. In the modest four-room apartment at 1637 51st Avenue in Cicero, Frank Christensen and his wife, Madeline, are having dinner.
Are you working again tonight, Frank?
That's right, honey.
Don't you think you've been working much too hard lately? Between your law practice and Boulevard Manor, you've been at it day and night. It's too much for one man.
You know, you're making it sound so tough, you almost convinced me to drop some of it.
I only wish I could.
Do you really?
No. No, I think I know pretty well what makes you tick, Frank. And I wouldn't want you any other way.
Yeah, you better not. Well, anyway, it'll only be for a couple more days. Then we'll be off for the farm. And you know what those Tennessee vacations do for me.
All right, Frank. I'll be good.
Does that mean I can depend on your leaving the novena services on time tonight and being home when I get here?
Only if you promise to pick up the papers.
Honey, you just made a deal.
It is approximately 9:15 on the night of December 9th, 1949. Frank Christensen finishes work at the subdivision, and with his friends Leo Kaspersky and Michael Litka, drives to the Alton Hotel for a bite to eat. It's approximately 10 o'clock as they return to the development, and Frank Christensen says goodnight, gets into his own car, and drives away. At 10:07, two cars speed down quiet residential 51st Avenue in Cicero. One of them suddenly pulls over to the curb and stops. A man gets out and starts to run. The other car, a black souped-up Ford, has pulled up in the middle of the street.
Get in this car!
At that moment, in the apartment of Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Mack, in-laws of Frank Christensen, at 1640 51st Avenue...
Joe, were those shots?
Well, I'll take a look outside. Claire, there's a man out there near the entrance, lying on the sidewalk. I'm going to call the police.
The minute this call is completed, Joseph Mack runs back outside. His wife stands at the window, watching, waiting for the police cars to arrive. She glances from time to time at the motionless figure lying near the vestibule. There's something about it that seems vaguely familiar. Then a dawning, growing certainty comes over her and she runs to the phone.
Madeline, this is Claire. Is Frank home yet?
Frank? Why, no. Why do you ask? Claire? Claire, that noise outside a while ago. Those firecrackers.
Madeline. Madeline!
As the arriving police officers examine the body on the sidewalk outside and wait for the ambulance, the front door of the apartment building at 1637 51st Avenue bursts open. Mrs. Frank Christensen runs frantically across the street.
Is it Frank?
Who's
it? Is it Frank? Joe, tell me, is it...
I thought I heard firecrackers. Frank? Frank, speak to me. Speak to me, Frank.
Here comes the squad roll. We better get him to the hospital fast.
Frank J. Christensen has been shot 8 times in the head and chest, in the back and arms. He's dead on arrival at Loretto Hospital. Meanwhile, the Cicero police dispatcher has notified the office of State's Attorney John S. Boyle in the criminal courthouse at 26th and California Streets in Chicago. Sergeant Nick Disseldorf, aide to Captain Daniel A. Gilbert, chief investigator, sets in motion the smoothly operating, efficient machinery of the criminal branch of the State's Attorney's office.
Pearson.
Hello, Charlie. Nick.
I hadn't known I'd get a call from you on a night like this. What is it and where?
A shooting at 1640 51st Avenue in Cicero.
Got it.
No further details or identification given on the first flash.
Okay, Nick, Rourke and I'll cover.
When Sergeant Charles Pearson and Patrolman John Rourke arrive on the scene, they begin an immediate inquiry into the shooting. Assistant State's Attorney Edward Healy also arrives.
Has an identification been made yet, Pearson?
Yes, sir. The man who was shot was Frank Christensen.
Christensen? We'd better get a hold of Boyle himself right away.
State's Attorney John S. Boyle is notified and arrives at the scene with his first assistant, Edward Breen. Captain Dan Gilbert and Sergeant Disseldorf also arrive. Within an hour, the state's attorney has over a dozen men on the spot. The investigation into the killing of Frank J. Christensen begins. An investigation that will not end until it's closed by a conviction. The following statements are obtained from three of Frank Christensen's friends and associates. They're of extreme interest to the state's attorney's office. The first is given to Assistant State's Attorney Edward Healy by John C. Stoffel.
Stoffel said that last year, during the summer of 1948, two swarthy men in a car curbed his auto on the 52nd Avenue overpass. One of them, carrying a pistol, jumped from the car and yelled at him, "Get out of the car, you!" Stoffel said he quickly threw his car into reverse, backed off the overpass, and got away. Now, I think it's quite significant that the words shouted at Stoffel are almost identically the same words shouted at Frank Christensen just before he was shot to death.
The second statement was given to Captain Dan Gilbert by Mr. Frank Kay, who is a law associate of Frank Christensen's.
Kay stated that at about 12:45 a.m. on the morning of December 9th, some 20 hours before the murder, he was driving on 35th Street when he noticed a car following him. When Kay arrived at his home at 3525 South 59th Court, the other car was right behind him, 1942 green-colored Plymouth, or Dodge, with two men in it. Afraid there was going to be a robbery, he went into his house and locked the door.
The third statement was made by Mr. Frank Balloon, former fire marshal of Cicero.
It was on Friday morning, December 9th. I was leaving my home. It's about 75 feet east of Frank Christensen's law office, and I noticed two foreign-looking men trying the door of Frank's office. Finding it was locked, they walked a half a block east and got into a green-colored Plymouth sedan. Both of the men were carrying briefcases, and they drove away. Well, there was plenty of parking space in front of Frank's office, so why did they park their car half a block away?
At 5 p.m., Saturday, December 10th, a man telephones Captain Gilbert. He says that he has some information regarding the death of Christensen. Sergeant Pearson leaves immediately to pick him up.
Look,
I don't want to get in no trouble. It didn't mean nothing to me until Christensen's murder, and then I figured I'd better let you know, but I don't want to get in no trouble.
Don't worry. We're just as anxious to conceal your name as you are. We'll call you, Smith. What's your story?
Well, about the end of October, maybe it was the first week in November, I was at Mike Litka's tavern. Leo Kaspersky was there, too, talking business with Mike. It was about 11 in the morning. There was two guys sitting at the end of the bar, not 6 feet from me, and I got a good look at both of them.
The two men Smith is describing are swarthy in appearance, foreign-looking, as he puts it. Both wear gray fedoras and dark overcoats. Both are about 5'8" or 5'9", between the ages of 35 and 40, and weigh 190 to 200 pounds. Then Leo Kaspersky, who knows Smith, walks over to him.
I thought that was you sitting there.
Oh, hello, Mr. Kaspersky.
I'm leaving now. If you're going my way, I can give you a lift.
Say, I'll take you up on that.
Fine. Come right along.
Smith rises and starts to follow. Then he notices that the two men seated at the end of the bar are staring after Kaspersky intently. And as he passes them, he hears...
We'll have to get rid of them, too, and I'll tell you why.
Did you say anything to Kaspersky about what you'd heard, Smith?
Like I said, Captain, it didn't mean nothing to me until after the murder. Then it hit me. Who else could they mean by them two they wanted to get rid of unless it was Kaspersky and Christensen?
The intensive investigation into the death of Frank Christensen is pursued relentlessly by the state's attorney's office, the Cicero police under Chief Chris Rooney. But no clear motive for his killer can be ascertained. No suspects uncovered. No clues as to the possible identity of his slayer or slayers. It's the morning of January 31st, 1950. In the matter of the inquest on the body of Frank J. Christensen, the coroner's jury is returning to the box after having retired and deliberated on their verdict.
Have you, gentlemen of the jury, agreed upon your verdict?
We have, sir. We find that the said Frank Christensen came to his death on the ninth day of December, A.D. 1949, from multiple gunshot wounds. Said wounds received from the pistol or revolvers held in the hands of two unknown persons. From the testimony presented, we, the jury, find said act to be murder and therefore recommend the police to apprehend said unknown persons, and when apprehended, they be held to the grand jury until released by due process of law.
Is that your verdict, gentlemen?
Yes.
Sign the verdict, and that'll close the inquest.
Now listen carefully, please. Listen, all of you, wherever you may be. We're going to give you a recapitulation of all the pertinent facts in the unsolved murder of Frank J. Christensen. Better make a note of them.
And remember, by following the instructions we shall give you in a moment, you may be the one to earn rewards totaling $10,000.
Now here are the actual facts in the case. Frank J. Christensen, 44 years of age, was shot to death across the street from his home at 1637 51st Avenue in Cicero, Illinois.
The time, approximately 10:07 p.m., Friday, December 9th, 1949.
He died of multiple bullet wounds from two different guns, believed to be .38 caliber Colt Specials.
His killers are believed to have been driving a 1940 or 41 black souped-up Ford. Also may have had a green Plymouth or Dodge sedan.
Now, two men are being sought as suspects in the killing. Here's their description, so please listen carefully.
They are between the ages of 35 and 40.
They have swarthy complexions. Witnesses all claim that they have a foreign look.
Height, 5'8" or 5'9". Weight, 190 to 200 pounds. When last seen, were wearing gray fedora hats and dark overcoats.
Ladies and gentlemen, many theories have been advanced as to the underlying motives in Frank J. Christensen's murder. Here's the opinion expressed by Assistant State's Attorney Edward Healy, who, in cooperation with Sergeant Charles Pearson and Patrolman John Rourke, is still officially working on the case.
I am convinced that the murder was a warning by the underworld to a strong reform group to keep their hands off the suburbs' government. Christensen had strong support for the post of first mayor of Cicero. He had a reputation as a vote-getter and would have been a tough candidate to beat in an election. Underworld bosses may have thought that by killing the reform group's number one candidate, they could scare off their other aspirants for the post.
Ladies and gentlemen, if any of you possesses information, and please don't send guesses or hunches, but actual, authentic information, follow these instructions so that your name and identity need never be made known unless you wish. Now listen very carefully.
Write your information on a plain sheet of paper. Do not sign your name. Instead, sign it with six numbers, any arrangement of any six numbers. Then tear off a blank corner of that paper with a ragged edge. Write the same six numbers on that corner and keep it. Mail the rest of the paper with the information to Somebody Knows, Hollywood, California. You need tell no one what you have done.
Mail your letter to Somebody Knows, Hollywood, California. And if the information you've supplied leads to the arrest and conviction of the killer or killers of Frank J. Christensen, we'll announce your signature number on this program. Then if you don't want your name to be known, go to your lawyer or your doctor, your priest, minister, or rabbi, and have him present the torn corner of the paper to any CBS station. In this way, you won't have to appear in person.
If the torn corner matches the original paper containing the information, the $10,000 in rewards will be yours.
Remember, you, wherever you are, you whose name need never be known, you may earn a reward of $10,000.
Next week, at the same time, we'll present another true case history of unsolved murder. Homicide file number 81550 of the Dallas, Texas Police Department. The murder of Leonard L. Lambert.
You out there, you who've murdered in cold blood, think you've gotten away with it. Listen, you cannot escape. There is no perfect crime. Remember, you are not unknown.
Somebody knows.
Tonight's case was written by Sidney Marshall from information in the files of the State's Attorney's Office of Cook County, Illinois. Research was by Maurice Zim. Music was composed and played by Milton Charles. Somebody Knows is a James L. Safier production in association with CBS, by arrangement with the Chicago Sun-Times, and is based on a copyright owned by W.L. Finstad. It was narrated and directed by Jack Johnstone. In order to be eligible for the $5,000 reward and the additional $5,000 reward that will be paid by Mrs. Madeline Christensen, a total of $10,000, letters containing actual, authentic information leading to the arrest and conviction of the killer or killers of Frank J. Christensen must be addressed to Somebody Knows, Hollywood, California, and postmarked not later than midnight, August 20th, 1950. Arrest of the guilty person or persons must occur within 90 days of that date, and conviction must be within 1 year of tonight's broadcast. If more than one person gives the information leading to conviction, our judges will divide the two $5,000 rewards among them in proportion to the importance the judges attach to the facts supplied, and in this, the decision of our judges will be final. Until next Thursday at the same time, this is Frank Goss saying good night, and remember,
Somebody Knows.
You'll always experience a top-rating thrill when Casey, crime photographer, embarks on a new adventure each Thursday night on CBS. Casey, crime photographer, is the man who uses his news camera instead of a gun when a criminal's at large. And often enough, his girlfriend Anne and his slow-talking pal Ethelbert fog up his plates more than the criminals do. For the fast action and lively dialogue of Crime Photographer, stay tuned, for Casey comes along immediately on most of these same CBS stations. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.